Welcome, folks. It's Mike Porky Parry here. You're listening to the latest episode of the podcast Planet Porky with our great friends at Audio Boom, Spotify, iTunes, Apple, you name it, you can go there and get it, okay? Now, thank you very much indeed for the terrific response we've had so far to the opening episodes of Planet Porky. And as we go on, we get better. I've had a tremendous reaction from you all. Thank you very much indeed for your responses to the latest feature here on Planet Porky, and that is that I decided once and for all to relate the issue of the first Mrs. Parry, okay? For many years when I was a radio broadcaster, and I've become a radio and TV broadcaster, I'm delighted to say, and of course I've worked in the print industry for a long time, never got married along the way, and for many, many years, people have said to me, you know, what happened? Where is the first Mrs. Parry? So I've decided to start telling the tale. Those of you who are regular listeners, and I'm delighted to say that that number is increasing by the day, and, you know, the Porky Army is mounting up, and thank you very much indeed for all your support. You've particularly latched on to these tales of where it all happened, if it happened, when it happened, why it happened, and then maybe in the end why it didn't happen. That's about me and my search for a partner in life. Now, let's get now to the first Mrs. Parry 3. We've had the first Mrs. Parry 1 and 2, the reasons why that didn't work out. Here's the third one, okay? We all know back in the newspaper world, and I have left Chester, where I was a reporter on the Chester Chronicle, and even though I say it myself, a pretty outstanding reporter, because I was only there 18 months before I was plucked from a weekly newspaper, the Chester Chronicle, to an evening newspaper, the Newcastle Evening Chronicle. You'll have heard in the last chapter of the first Mrs. Parry that I'd already been to Newcastle to train, and they'd spotted me up there on the training course, which lasts for about 6 months, and they'd always said, if you ever want to come back, there's a place for you here. So 18 months later, after serving my pupillage, as you might call it, on the Chester Chronicle, I ended up back in Newcastle. Now, the interesting thing was, in those 18 months back in Chester, there were two newspapers in Chester. One was called the Chester Chronicle I worked on. The other one was the Cheshire Observer, OK? And on the Cheshire Observer, there was a very, very attractive, very good-looking female reporter. But we weren't allowed to kind of talk to each other because, it was the enemy, the opposition. It's very unusual for a small town like Chester, population of about 65 or 70,000 people, to have two weekly newspapers. But we did. And so you'd turn up at council meetings and at courts and inquests and, you know, local stories involving the mayor and all that kind of stuff, double-handed. When I say double-handed, one from the Chronicle, one from the Observer, right? I always hoped that this particular lady, who shall remain anonymous because she will have gone on and had a great life elsewhere. I know she had a great life in newspapers, became an outstanding newspaper reporter, and then, you know, I think she found domestic bliss in life, which is great. But I feel such a cad about this particular tale I'm going to tell you, you know, the first Mrs. Parry chapter 3, because in many ways I feel a bit of a guilt complex. I'll tell you exactly what happened, okay? So eventually we get together in Chester, and we had to do it in a very clandestine fashion because you weren't allowed to associate with the opposition. But what happened was, we turned up one night at the gang show, OK? Now, that's a very unusual place to meet. But there was a theatre in Chester called the Gateway Theatre. And it was pretty popular, you know, touring bands used to go there. Not huge ones. Do you remember a guy called George Melly? He was a big fat guy who used to wear sort of outlandish suits, you know, big checks, stripes and all that, and a fedora hat. And he was a jazz performer, and he became sort of popular amongst people of our age, you know, 20, 21-year-olds, because he was outlandish, bombastic. He'd get on the stage, He'd play a bit of saxophone or something like a trumpet. No, I think he played the trumpet, a sax player, a piano player. And he took a lot of drink during the course of the show. So, of course, we all liked him. And he was very outgoing. So he was one of the guys at the Gateway Theatre Chester. We used to get free tickets to all these things because in terms of Chester, I'm not joking, we were important people. I know that sounds ridiculous, a weekly newspaper reporter, but anybody who had a business in Chester always wanted to get their business, a picture of themselves or what they were doing in the paper. So we were popular everywhere. You know, we could get into all the local nightclubs without a shadow of a doubt by walking to the front of the queue, which I'll tell you about in a minute. But what happened on this night was at the gang show. The gang show goes on every Christmas in Chester. The Gateway Theatre's gone now. They've got another one. But the gang show, as many of you might know, is the show put on by the Scouts and the Cubs. Now, I'm not sure whether the Scouts and the Cubs and the Brownies all get together these days, but in those days it was. And their theme tune, by the way, is we're rolling along on the crest of a wave, and you know, it's all that kind of stuff, you know what I mean? And these guys all give up their time voluntarily. The guys who run the scout troop, you know, professional men, all this kind of stuff, who gave up their time and got into their scout uniforms and put their woggles on, if that's what it's called, you know, a thing around the neck. And the show would go on, you see. So we had to go down and we had to review it and give it a great review. So that then when the review appeared in the paper, loads of people would go and buy a ticket and go and watch the gang show in the week before Christmas, and lots of money would be raised for charity. It was all a very good thing. So anyway, I end up there, and so does this lady. I tell you what, for the sake of identification, we will call this lady Belinda, OK? Belinda. And she was a very attractive lady. And she had a bit of a reputation for being a bit aloof and standoffish. But she wasn't. She was just, you know, very sophisticated, really, and very charming and very bright. So anyway, watching the gang show is not exactly the greatest entertainment for two 21-year-olds. I think we were 21 then, yeah. And Belinda had come from a very good school. I don't think she'd gone to university. She'd gone into journalistic training and then came and worked on the Cheshire Observer. Great. Three quarters of the way through this dreadful gang show, you know, ging, gang, gooly, 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 watcha, ging, gang, goo, ging, gang, goo, and all that sort of stuff, you know. And I'm not knocking it, by the way. It's a very valuable contribution to any local community like Chester was. Three quarters of the way through, we both decided we'd had enough, seen enough, and decided that a better view would be to leave. So it was then probably about 9:30, I suppose. You know, they didn't have these things too late because lots of kids used to come and watch them. Probably wasn't even 9:30. It's probably started 7:30, so probably about 9:00. We decided to go to a new wine bar, you know, near the city walls, Chester city walls. You know, I said to her, why don't we get out? Yeah, great. So we're in this wine bar, and I remember Belinda insisted on buying the first bottle of wine, and it was Bull's Blood, which apparently is Hungarian red wine, which I'd never come across before. I wasn't really a wine drinker. I was a lager man in those days, you know, maybe 12 pints a day. During and after work. And so we sat there and, you know, it was an immediate attraction between myself and this lady. And we had a few drinks that night. And you've got to remember, in those days, there were no mobile phones. So we had to be incredibly careful about how we kept in touch, because I couldn't ring her in her office in the Cheshire Observer, which was on the other side of Bridge Street in Chester, from the Chester Chronicle. Two offices were literally opposite each other, 50 yards apart, if you see what I mean. And no way in the world could we start ringing each other up at work. So what we had to do is, I lived with my folks in those days before I moved into a place with some friends. I'd just come back from training in Newcastle, and she lived with hers. And so we had to make phone calls kind of, you know, late in the evening, because I never usually got home till about 10, because every day we went to the pub after work and got bladderated with a pint of lager in the Diva Hotel. Sometimes I would go meet her after work and we'd go somewhere, you know, hopefully quiet, but occasionally we'd get spotted and we had to pretend that we were talking professionally about some story we'd been working on, something like that, swapping shorthand notes or something like that, you know. But anyway, the point of the story is, where this all works out is that eventually the call came to me to go back to Newcastle. Newcastle. And I was going up there to work for the Chester Chronicle. So it was, you know, kind of heartbreaking because the romance was definitely developing without a shadow of a doubt. So, but I am, when it comes to, as you will have heard from the previous two Search for Mrs. Parry episodes, I can be very focused when it comes to career. And my career has always overtaken any semblance of private life. I shoot off in the January of the new year, whichever year it was, probably about 76, something like that, 1976. I go up to Newcastle and I get myself in a house with two other guys who were much more senior reporters on the Newcastle Evening Chronicle, who tried to treat me a bit like a sort of an underling, you know, junior and all that, but they soon learnt not to. And many years later, I became the boss, and not of, in Newcastle, but on Fleet Street when they were applying for jobs, and I didn't like their character really, you know, and all that kind of stuff. But anyway, that's by the by. The point of the story is, in the first few weeks I was there, Belinda came to see me, and there was only one double bed in the house in which I lived with the two other guys, so I did a deal with them, paid them, and took over the room with the double bed in. Went out and bought some new bedding and all that, so Belinda and I would feel, you know, perfectly happy and comfortable for the couple of days, two or three days that she was going to be there. So that actually improved the romance and the relationship because absence made the heart grow fonder. Now then, Belinda went back to Chester, and unbeknown to me, she started making all sorts of approaches to the news editor of the New Evening Chronicle that I worked on in Newcastle to try and get there. She was doing it to surprise me. And I couldn't believe it when a guy called John Ritson, who was the news editor, announced to me one morning, I went into work, you must be well pleased. I said, why is that? He said, well, you know, I've fixed it. I said, what have you fixed? He said, Belinda, she's coming to work. Excuse me, air conditioning. I said, I didn't know anything about it. Anyway, as I say, there were no mobile phones in those days, so I was then able to ring Belinda in her office, the Cheshire Observer in Chester, and say, John, he must be joking, mustn't he? And she said, no, darling, it's wonderful, I'm coming. What? I'm coming to Newcastle. I've got a job on the Evening Chronicle with you. Now, this was bad news. I'd started a relationship in Newcastle, okay, and that was going quite well. And it was with a lady who was blonde-haired, and Belinda was very auburn. She's very dark-haired, sorry. This was going to cause me a huge problem because I had imagined that the relationship with Belinda would just peter out, okay? But in fact, it was now causing me a problem. So there was another issue as well, and the issue was that I was actually quite largely unhappy in Newcastle. It was the era of union-dominated power in industry in this country. I'm talking about the mid-70s to the late 70s, you know, sort of 76, 77. Unions ran the country. And one of the strongest unions, some of the strongest unions, were in the newspaper and print industry. And there wasn't a day we didn't go in when somebody was on strike, either the van drivers or the printers, or the journalists. I spent many days sitting around in the newsroom at the Evening Chronicle because we were on strike or go slow over some pay issue or something like that. And I didn't like it. So unbeknown to Belinda, I had already made tremendous strides in leaving Newcastle and going to an even bigger paper, which was always my ambition, which was the Birmingham Evening Mail in Birmingham, OK? And I'd been down to Birmingham twice. I'd fixed the job, and I was going to work in a district office called Redditch, OK? So what happened was, Belinda arrives. I mean, lock, stock and barrel, didn't even come up, you know, for a week or two's trial. She just suddenly arrived. So Obviously, I had to move her into my place. And we actually had a phone there because one of the lads I'm talking about who moved in had got a job as the news editor on the Journal, which was the morning paper. And for the first time ever, I lived in a house that wasn't my parents', which had a phone. So she came up. I went home after work to find her there. She was starting work the following Monday. This was a Thursday afternoon. And that phone rang. And it was a guy called Barry Lloyd Williams, who was executive editor of the Birmingham Mail. And I answered the phone because I was the only one in. The other two guys worked on the Journal, which meant they didn't get home until 9 or 10 at night, whereas I started at sort of 5 or 6 in the morning on the evening paper, and I was always home at 3 or 4 in the afternoon. If I went home, didn't usually, usually went to the pub all afternoon for the rest of the evening. But on this day, I was waiting for this phone call from this Barry Lloyd Jones. Anyway, Belinda was there, phone goes, I pick up the phone. Hello, yeah, hi, Barry. Yeah, Mike, we can confirm. Want to offer you the job, all sorted. You can start, you know, week after next. Can you get here that quickly? And I said, yes, that's great. Thanks very much indeed. I put the phone down. Belinda was standing next to me. She said, what's all that about? I said, look, I'm really, really sorry. I said, but I'm actually not staying in Newcastle. I'm leaving. Oh, why didn't you tell me? And I said, well, because that phone call was just to confirm I've got the job. I didn't know I had the job until right now. But it's a bigger paper. It's great for the career. You've come here for your career. I've got to go there. But of course, you can come and join me. And she was heartbroken. She'd come to Newcastle to see me. Anyway, to cut a long story short, I went to Birmingham. I did very well there, and I've always done very well in newspaper reporting jobs. And by that time, I'd lost the desire to want to pursue my romance with Belinda. I'd met a lady in Birmingham, which will probably be the next chapter of the search for the first Mrs. Parry. You can see why I feel somewhat guilty, except for the fact that Belinda went to Newcastle because of me, and she spent, I think, the next 25 or 30 years there and did extremely well. She became very highly rated. She took several specialist jobs. She also got into a great pension fund, as I understand. And she left eventually in very good shape. She had a detached house. She was one of the most respected journalists in the northeast of England. So though some of you may say it was callous and cruel what I did, it wasn't, honestly, because she found that she'd like Newcastle and could do it without me, Mike Parry, the Porkmeister, and she certainly did. Right, OK, folks, so I've just been telling you, haven't I, about the first Mrs. Parry chapter 3. Got all out of the way. Now, let's talk about other issues which affect Planet Porky, OK? Because you are listening to Life on Planet Porky. This is the latest episode, and I want to talk to you about this increasingly, in my view, sinister practice of trying to sell products in this country that don't have any colourful packaging, i.e. people want to put them into plain packaging to allegedly try and stop children, or in the case of sweets and cans of pop and all that kind of stuff, or adults in the case of cigarettes and cigars and tobacco in that kind of way, from being able to choose the very product they want, because if you see colourful things and if you see, I mean, listen, I'm not sure how many people around here will remember collecting cigarette packets. Now, I'm not joking about this. I'm absolutely serious about this, OK? When I was a kid, you used to collect cigarette packets, and the reason was because cigarette packets were not solid packets. They were a tray of cigarettes inside folded over into silver paper, and they were pushed into a sleeve, if you understand what I mean. So a bit like, you know, if you imagine an old-style VHS video that you pushed into the cardboard sleeve, except that there was no bottom to the sleeve. The sleeve was open at both sides, if you see what I mean. That's how cigarettes used to be sold in this country. And as a consequence, and there were hundreds of brands, by the way, post-war, this country was flooded with cigarettes from America and, you know, all sorts of places all over the world, and lots of them were made here. But as a consequence of that, what kids used to do is collect the sleeves, and then the sleeves became a bit like football cards, really, you know, beer mats, whatever you want to call them, huge collections of these cigarette packet sleeves. And then you used to use them like playing cards and, you know, trade them and all that kind of stuff. I mean, sounds balmy, but that's what kids did in those days. But there was nothing more colourful than going to a tobacconist, OK? Now, a lot of you will say, what's a tobacconist? Well, a tobacconist was a place where the guy who ran it just sold tobacco for pipes, and he sold cigarettes, but he sold hundreds of different brands of cigarettes. And it was the most colourful shop in the high street, and every high street had one, all right? Now, of course, over the years, last two decades, three decades, because of the health worries of cigarette, and very rightly, because you won't believe this, but even in the 50s, right? I was born in the 50s. And although I can't remember this, I've looked back, and there were some doctors in the 50s, like, you know, 1958, 1959, who refused to endorse in any way the link between smoking tobacco, cigarettes, and lung cancer. I mean, literally, they wouldn't endorse it. No, lung cancer was something that happened to miners. It was something that happened to people who worked in buildings that were full of asbestos, although they hadn't picked up on that at that time. But no connection with cigarettes at all. I mean, it was so bizarre that some of the best adverts on TV were guys, you know, like looking like cowboys riding across the plain, stopping and lighting a Marlboro cigarette, you know, Marlboro, the man's cigarette, and all this kind of stuff. And I think one person who actually advertised cigarettes in those days in America was a guy called Ronald Reagan. And Ronald Reagan, of course, went on to become a Republican president of the United States of America. He was a sort of B-movie actor, and people mock him for that, but no reason in the world should you mock Ronald Reagan, because he became the president, and you can't do much better than that. Anyway, getting back to the cigarette situation. So first of all, we had these ghastly adverts on the side of cigarette packets saying this is what happens to your lungs, you know, if you smoke cigarettes. Well, I think most people in the 60s and the 70s got to understand that, and smoking has reduced in this country. But I do not like nanny statism. And so what happened within the last 10 years now, so we're now in 2019, so I would say, you know, around about, I don't know, certainly in the first decade of this century, all of a sudden, cigarettes were not allowed to have colourful covers on their packets. First of all, I think they were all made to be black. And then secondly, and quite preposterously, they were ordered to be sold only out of sight. So you go into supermarkets these days and you go into shops and all that, and you see these sliding doors behind the guy or the lady who's serving you at the counter, and you slide the door back, and there you've got like thousands of packets of cigarettes, but they're all the same colour. Now, this can be difficult. Occasionally, I have smoked, OK? Sometimes if I've gone on holiday or I've gone away for the weekend to, you know, a great party and I'm going to be staying down in the country or something, I don't mind a cigarette. The problem is, because I can't identify one black packet of cigarettes from another, I have no idea what I'm smoking. And that is dreadful that you're not allowed choice, OK? It is quite ridiculous and utterly wrong that we are treated like children. If the cigarettes still looked like they looked in the 60s, 70s, the 80s, big colourful packets, then you'd be able to actually identify the sort of cigarette you want to smoke and the strength of it. But now you go and say, oh, just give me anything, and you could be given anything. Now, I mean, for instance, my mother and father both smoked. My dad smoked until he sadly died. I remember that as kids, they both made efforts to give it up. My mum smoked Woodbines, and they were little cigarettes in little packets, which lots of women smoked, you know. And you won't believe this, folks, but I can remember sitting at home in Laurel Grove in Chester, myself and my two sisters, watching Morecambe and Wise, and each of my parents had an ashtray next to them. My dad had one on a big sort of, stalk, if you see what I mean, like a big wooden, contraption with a cigarette, with an ashtray on the top. And mum had a little one which sort of fitted over the arm of her chair. And they would smoke all the way through Morecambe and Wise. The whole room, this was in the living room at our home, was just full of smoke. They didn't even open the windows in the winter because it was too cold. We didn't have any central heating. So they'd sit there smoking one after the other. These cigarette butts piled up in the ashtrays, okay. You know, I mean, cigarette butts and ash is really a very unattractive sort of vision, you know, particularly for kids aged about 8 or 9 or 10 or something. But that was the way of life. When our dad drove us to school, because we went to a school that was on the way to where he worked, right? Quite long journeys, quite a few miles, and then he went on to work in Liverpool because we lived in Chester. And the school was about halfway there. He would smoke in the car. And again, never open the windows because, you know, it was simply too cold. There was too much wind blowing into the car, which used to blow the ash off his cigarette into his face, so he didn't want that. He'd rather smoke in the car. And the car, we used to go into school and smell of smoke. You know, our school uniforms were impregnated with the smoke from cigarettes. Now, it sounds ridiculous, but that's the way it was. Anyway, let's get back to the original story. My mum gave up smoking. I think it was before my dad died, and my dad died before my mum was 50. My mum lived until she was 85, so she was a widow for a long time, but I never remember her smoking after my dad died. We're not really quite sure what my dad died of. He smoked until he died, and that undoubtedly, the doctors will tell you, contributed to the heart condition that he had, which is exactly the same as mine. When I say I'm not exactly sure what he died of, he had dilated cardiomyopathy, which is what I've got and which I've had now for over 15 years. We don't know how long my dad had it, but something triggered it. Don't know whether it was smoking. My dad didn't drink a lot. He had a few drinks after we all left home and all that, but he suddenly died. But undoubtedly, smoking is obviously not good for you and you shouldn't. Mum gave it up. She gave the woodbines up. That was great. Anyway, look. The reason I'm talking about all this and the cigarette story is because I am now appalled to see that what I would call the socialism of the marketplace, right, or the socialism of consumerism, is now reaching out to sweets, crisps and sugary drinks, right? So the state is now trying to take more and more control of our lives. The state has already told us you cannot choose what sort of cigarette you want. Now, whether you are for or against cigarette smoking, most people should be against it because obviously it's not good for you. Nevertheless, it's one of the freedoms that we enjoy in the Western world. And if people want to spend ridiculously, I understand a packet of cigarettes costs about £12 these days. Most of that's tax, but nevertheless, that is a huge amount of money to have to pay just to burn. I mean, you literally are burning money when you smoke cigarettes. Nevertheless, if people do that, I think they should be allowed to make a choice of what they're buying. Now, so I was horrified to find out that a report I've got here from one of my journals, sweets, crisps and sugary drinks should be in plain packaging to reduce pester power from children. Health campaigners have announced. Health campaigners? It would make the food look less appealing and is necessary to combat the obesity crisis. The Institute for Public Policy Research also calls for the products to be taxed, their adverts banned from daytime TV, and for supermarkets to fund healthy cooking classes for customers. Critics say plain packaging, like with cigarettes, will make shops grey and boring and do nothing for waistlines. Now, I'm telling you, this is going down a route which is very dangerous indeed. I was fortunate to go to the Soviet Union when the Soviet Union was still communist, OK? Not many people went there in those days. The reason I went there was because I was a hotshot in Fleet Street. I was the executive editor of the Daily Express. And as it was coming up to the fall of the Berlin Wall, which I think was 91, that's when communism collapsed, right? You could see the signs. You could see that it was weakening and it was crumbling. And so I was given the task to try and set up a bureau in Moscow in the years before the wall fell, because Mr. Gorbachev, who was then the much, much more liberal-leaning leader of the Soviet Union than any they'd had before, realised, I think, that the game was up, OK? And so he started relaxing rules on foreigners and all that. You'll remember the two expressions that were used for the easing of Soviet tyranny, glasnost and perestroika. One meant openness and the other one meant sharing information, OK? Mr. Gorbachev realised that after meetings with President Ronald Reagan, who I've mentioned already once in this podcast, the game was up. Because America had become so rich, Reagan actually said at a summit in Iceland, you know, Mikhail, his name was Mikhail Gorbachev, he was a guy who Mrs. Thatcher once said, I can do business with, Mrs. Margaret Thatcher, that is. He said, Mikhail, for every ruble you spend on a nuclear weapon, I will spend 10 US dollars, which was actually about 100 times the value of one ruble, OK? And Gorbachev realised it was up, eased the rules. We managed to get over to Moscow. We bought a couple of council flats from the mayor of Moscow. It was all very corrupt in those days. The whole of Soviet society was very corrupt. And we knocked the walls between them out and we got a set of builders from Finland to come in and build us a bureau. The Daily Express had the first bureau behind the Iron Curtain in Fleet Street. I was part of that. And the man who ran it was Peter Hitchens, a brilliant guy, great journalist, a terrific operator, a man who actually took a lot of the equipment into Moscow in suitcases on a train, you know, through places like, God knows, Poland, I think, and all that kind of stuff, you know. Anyway, the point of my story is, once Peter was installed there, I got a visa to go and see him and look at the bureau. And you've never seen anything like Soviet Russia. No colour. No colour whatsoever. Billboards, if they existed, were only for state messages. There was no colour. There was no colour in the street. There was no colour in people's clothes. There was no colour in the cars. Everything was the same colour. Black, sort of white and grey. That's all it was in Russia in those days. Russia being, you know, the biggest country in the Soviet Union, USSR. But the one thing I remember about communism stroke socialism is the complete lack of colour. There were restaurants, but they were only for the privileged, for the KGB and for the senior officers of the Central Communist Party. And even then, there wasn't really much colour. We got into them because we were favoured foreigners. You know, we represented news organisations. We could put a message out about Russia and its determination to reform. But I can't tell you how miserable a country it was. In many ways, it was very beautiful. Because the skyline, as you look down the Moscow River, you know, if you're on a bridge coming out of Red Square, walked over the Moscow River, the Kaplinsky Hotel these days is just on the other side, magnificent five-star hotel. Nothing like that in those days. You looked left and you looked right, you looked down the road, there was no colour, honestly. There was no green grass, there was nothing. Red Square itself is cobbled. And that's why I feel so strongly that once you start taking colour out of things, you are heading down a path of we must all be the same. You have no choice. There is nothing here to excite you in our society. And I'm very, very worried. And people will laugh and say, don't be ridiculous. What's it got to do with socialism? Socialism is about everybody being equal. And we know it doesn't work. It's never worked anywhere in the world. It never worked in Russia. It never worked behind the Iron Curtain. It's never worked in Cuba. It has destroyed countries like Venezuela. But the first sign of people trying to think like that is, hang on, nobody must have an advantage here by being able to pick something out because of the colour. It's all got to be the same. You think I'm mad, but please think on. Because I know I'm right. You have been listening to Planet Porky. I said, look, I'm really, really sorry. I said, but I'm actually not staying in Newcastle. I'm leaving. Oh, why didn't you tell me? And I said, well, because that phone call was just to confirm I've got the job. I didn't know I had the job until right now. But it's a bigger paper. It's great for the career. You've come here for your career. I've got to go there. But of course, you can come and join me. And she was heartbroken. She'd come to Newcastle to see me. Anyway, to cut a long story short, I went to Birmingham. I did very well there. And I've always done very well in newspaper reporting jobs. And by that time, I'd lost the desire to want to pursue my romance with Belinda. I'd met a lady in Birmingham, which will probably be the next chapter of The Search for the First Mrs. Parry. Once you start taking colour out of things, you are heading down a path of we must all be the same. You have no choice. There is nothing here to excite you in our society. And I'm very, very worried. And people will laugh and say, don't be ridiculous. What's it got to do with socialism? Socialism is about everybody being equal. And we know it doesn't work. Rolling along on the crest of a wave, and you know, it's all that kind of stuff, you know what I mean?